Is it possible a cur can lend 3,000 ducats? Or shall I bend low? And in a slavish voice, with bated breath and whispering humbleness, say this. Fair sir, you spat on me on Wednesday last. You spurned me such a day. Another time, you called me dog. And for these courtesies, I'll give you thus much money.
To call you sir again. To spit on you again, to spurn you too. If you would lend this money, lend it not unto your friends. For when did friendship take a breed for barren metal from his friends? But lend it rather to your enemy, who if he break, you may with better face exact the penalty.
Why, look how you storm. I would be friends with you and have your love. Forget the stays that you have shamed me with. Supply your present wants. And take not a drop of interest for my monies, and you'll not hear me.
This is kind, I offer.
This is kindness.
No.
This kindness I will show.
Go with me to a notary and seal me there your single bond, and in a merry sport, if you repay me not on such a day, in such a place, such a sum or sums as are expressed in the condition, let the forfeit be nominated for an equal pound of your fair flesh to be cut off and taken in what part of your body pleaseth me.
Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Dr. E. Michael Jones back on the show. Of course, to my audience, he needs no introduction, but I'll do it anyway. He is the editor of Culture Wars magazine, culturewars.com, the author of many books, including the most recently published The Dangers of Beauty, The Conflict Between Mimesis and Concupiscence in the Fine Arts. Dr. Jones, how are you doing this evening?
Good, Tim. Good to be here.
Well, thank you for coming back on the show. Well, I don't know. I think you have an article in next month's Culture Wars that might touch on not this particular topic, but a related topic. And perhaps you can fill us in on it, give us the highlights of that article. But recently there was this dust up or controversy between Steven Crowder and Ben Shapiro's Daily Wire. And I wanted to have you come on the show to talk about this. This was an example of Jewish capitalism, and this is how the dispute kind of highlights the Jewish strategy of leveraging financial power to take over society, more or less. And this is perhaps the inevitable result when a society forsakes God and worships mammon. Crowder versus Shapiro, what's the story here?
Well, first of all, when Crowder opened up this can of worms, he said, I got this contract. I'm not going to tell you who it was with, but we're really talking about conservatism here. And there's a big battle in conservatism between big tech, big con and little con. And big con is associated with big tech. Well, at this point, we are totally befuddled. I mean, what is going on here? First of all, we have to establish a principal fact here, that conservatism means absolutely nothing. Okay, it's a designation, a category of the mind that gets applied to keep you stupid. And this was an example of it. So at that point, suddenly, I think it was Mark Dice was the first guy who said, oh, it's the Daily Wire. And then the guy Boring from the Daily Wire actually got on and started talking about it himself. He said, yes, it was for the Daily Wire. And then he started going through the contract line by line. Now, at this point, it turns out that Stephen Crowder was offered $50 million for 3 years. Well, that's for doing YouTube videos. Well, you know, who can argue with that, right? And this was basically the line that Mark Dice taught, you know, like just shut up and take your money. But when you look at the contract, this is what Crowder was upset about. So I think he is greedy. He had an agent. They wanted a lot more money, and they were trying to leverage this, and I think they were trying to intimidate. It backfired on him because the Daily Wire got furious at him. But once the Daily Wire enters the thing, then we got something else we can go on. It's not just about conservatism. It's about the Jews. The Daily Wire is a Jewish operation. It's paid the figure, what should I say? The galleon, the lead guy is Ben Shapiro. So if you don't have it, depends. See, it's a category problem. We're always running into category problems. You got the category conservative, which means absolutely nothing now. But the one thing it does mean is it's a prevents you from saying the word Jew. And this is precisely what Crowder did. And it's precisely what Ben Shapiro does. So when he showed up at the Right to Life banquet, he gives this long, boring speech, preaching to the choir, telling him how they could refute pro-life arguments, didn't address the biggest issue since the overthrow of Roe versus Wade, which is basically that 140, now 400 Jewish organizations have said that abortion is a fundamental Jewish value. So when I walked up to the microphone and said that, you could feel the tension in the audience because, you know, polite people don't talk this way. We're all in this together, aren't we? Blah, blah, blah. But so you got conservatism, which is meaningless pretty much, it goes to the highest bidder. And so if the Koch brothers put their money behind it, then they determine what conservatism is and you become a Koch sucker. On the other hand, you have the category of reality, which is the Jews, which is constantly in dispute. And the whole point of conservatism, as I said, is to not say the word Jew. And the whole point of the Daily Wire and what Ben Shapiro is doing is not say the word Jew. Constantly transpose what are ethnic religious battles into battles on the political spectrum. So that's what happened. Once that cat got out of the bag, then we had something to go on. Because now you have a category. I can't tell you how important this category is. And the proof that it's important is the Jews don't want you to say it. They don't want to use that. The line that Dave Chappelle used in that famous monologue now on Saturday Night Live was, there are two words you should never put together, the and Jews. And everybody laughed. But what we're talking about is a significant category of reality that allows you to understand all kinds of stuff that you wouldn't understand if you were deprived of that category, which is precisely the point of conservatism, precisely the point of the Daily Wire. Now, you can go on. Jordan Peterson apparently just signed a big contract, probably bigger than this one, with the Daily Wire. And you can say Jew, he says it. He tells you how the Israelis have a right to occupy Palestinian territory and steal their property. So you can use it, but you can't use it in any explanatory or negative way. So that's what happened. So since I have the category, little bell started to ring, and I'm saying, where have I heard this story before? Oh, wait a minute. I just did an article on this. And the article is about Jack Nicklaus. Now, what does Jack Nicklaus have to do with conservatism and whatever? What does this have, what does he have to do with that? He's a golfer, isn't he? Yeah, he's a golfer. So how does this fit in? Well, it turns out that there's an article, a lawsuit just filed, and Jack Nicklaus was similar to doing what Crowder did. He had finished his career, he had retired, and he decided to find out how much he was worth. Yeah, not only was he did he win every tournament, probably made a ton of money doing that. He also had a business where he designed golf courses. So how much am I worth? So he hires this group of people, and they came up with a figure of $295 million. Okay, now that's fine. I think it reminds me of the man in the Bible who had a big harvest and decided to build two barns. Maybe you should leave well enough alone here, or maybe you should share your wealth with the poor or something like that. But anyway, he decided to monetize that. Now, there's all sorts of significant economic issues here. Is money an accurate indicator of wealth? Are money and wealth the same thing? Well, the dictionary says they are. I don't think they are, though. I think that there's a distinction here. Wealth is more lasting than money. Money is ephemeral. But anyway, Jack went for the money. And so someone pops up willing to give him $150 million, and his name is Howard Milstein. Okay, so great, you're going to give me, and it's for 49% of the whatever this thing is called, the Jack Nicklaus Corporation, let's call it. He had a name for it. Well, Jack thinks, great. How can you argue with $150 million? Three times what Crowder was offered. And so he signs a deal, and here is the nub of the issue here. This is a long, complicated contract. And it's, I'm going to say, here's another category that we have to deal with. It's a predatory contract. There are lots of things. Predatory contracts have a long history with the Jews. They're associated with usury. We could talk about the predatory contract in literature, in which case we're talking about Faust. The Faust story, Dr. Faustus, Christopher Marlowe's play. Goethe did a Faust play. And we're talking about basically the emergence of the money economy and its borrowing money and its usury. Well, it turns out that part of the contract that Jack Nicklaus signed had clauses like this. And I don't know, I guess he didn't get anybody to read it because he started complaining that basically I had no idea of what I signed. So anyway, part of the contract is if such and such happens, then kind of like the one that Crowder got. And it turns out that the if did happen right after he signed it, the recession hit, the Great Recession of 2007, 2008. And at this point, Mr. Milstein comes back and informs Jack that, oh, by that way, that $150 million, it was a loan, actually, because you didn't read the clause here. And by the way, your company now has to pay us 8.5% on this loan. And by the way, you also signed away saying the fact that we get first dibs on your money. So the first $12 million that comes in from the Jack Nicklaus Corporation goes directly to us. And if there's anything left over, then, well, you can have that. So suddenly Jack is upset because what we're talking about here is a predatory contract. Just like I think that Crowder's contract was predatory. I think that what he was basically signing on to was, if you get deplatformed, we take the money back. Well, how the hell can you know whether you're going to get deplatformed or not? Especially when you're in the business here of being controversial in some sense or other.
Yeah, the rules always change, as we know. Yeah.
So the rules are constantly changing here, according to this contract that nobody can figure out. These contracts are so arcane. By the way, Mr. Milstein.
Who decides the rules? What category, what group?
Yeah, of course, the Jew who writes the contract. Of course. And guess where he went to school? Harvard Business School. Okay, so this is where he learned how to do these predatory contracts. That's where he learned how to do it. So at some point, Nicholas wakes up and realizes, hey, this guy is in total control of my life. I mean, literally, literally, he recognized at a certain point, you know, this is Jack Nicholas. They're guys calling up. Hey, Jack, remember me? Yeah, sure, I remember you. Well, Jack, I'd like to talk to you about a golf course project. Jack is not allowed to talk to this guy until he asked the Jew Milstein for his permission. So at this point, Nicholas discovered not only that he had no control over the organization that he founded, he also discovered that he had no longer the right to talk to potential clients. Once Howard Milstein had taken permanent control of the country, he acted, and this is what Nicholas is saying, he acted as if he owned me. This is in the affidavit that Nicholas got. Mm-hmm.
Much more than a pound of flesh.
A pound of flesh would be good here. Nicholas goes on to say, he tried to control every aspect of my life, from what I did to whom I spoke with, to where I went, as if I was his property. I always tried to be respectful, but there was no respect in return. I also tried very hard to make the relationship work, but it became increasingly obvious that I aligned myself with a person who didn't respect me as a human being. So on November 23rd, this is the article, this is good, quote, a Manhattan judge, close quote. Now, what do you think that means? Why do you think Bankman-Fried left Jamaica and wanted to be put on trial in New York? On November 23rd, a Manhattan judge sided with Milstein and effectively ruled that Nicholas cannot use his, quote, own name, image, or likeness in connection with commercial ventures in which I am involved in the future, close quote. He's 82 years old, and he's the victim of identity theft. This is the predatory contract here. And if you don't have a category called the Jew, you can't understand it. Now, why do I say that? I know, I'm sorry, whenever you say something like this, someone's going to say, this is the category of your mind. This is not there. The word Jew did not show up once in this Sports Illustrated article that I'm quoting here. Not once. So you're left to infer this on your own. Of course, it's true. So it's a category of my mind, and it's an indication that I'm an anti-Semite, right? Right. You've heard this before, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's pattern recognition.
Okay. So I'm a guy who has spent his whole life forming categories, you know, and they're all locked up in my brain, my mind somewhere. And I remember another book that I was reading, which had something similar, very similar. And it was called Jews Must Live. And it's by a man by the name of Samuel Roth. And you probably never heard of Samuel Roth.
Because no, can't say I have, no.
Okay, he's famous, or he was infamous, because he was probably the 20th century's most famous pornographer. He spent 9 years in prison for selling pornography.
Was he the figure in the Roth decision, or just that's just another Roth?
Yeah, it is. That's
okay. There you go. So I have heard of him. Okay, there you go. Okay.
So he was a pornographer, which means you're a publisher. And two of the most famous books he published were Ulysses by James Joyce and Lady Chatterley's Lover by D.H. Lawrence. Well, this is a significant guy. He shows up as a character in Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. But why is he significant? Because he sort of tells it from the inside. So now we're going back, what is it, 80 years now? Back to Samuel Roth, who wrote this book about how Jews cheat you. That's what the book's about, because he got cheated by Jews. The Jew, he got cheated by Jews. So he goes, this is what he writes. He says, to my innocent brain, it appeared that the whole purpose of a Jew in business was to get the best of the goy. When the goy had been cheated, business was good. When the Jew had come out even, business was very bad indeed. For the greater the harm he had done in a business transaction with a joy, the deeper appeared the narrative delight of the Jew to whom I was listening. Now, he's talking about conversations he's had with Jews. And then he goes into detail about exactly what happened to Jack Nicholas and what could have happened to Steven Crowder if he signed on with that predatory contract. So basically, he goes into the story about there's a Mr. Hanley, who's a furniture manufacturer from the Midwest. The Jew comes to him and says, would you like to double your business? Well, what businessman is going to say no to that? So at this point, the Jew says, well, okay, a good idea. Let's get together. I know someone who will lend you money. Up, there's the problem. And so it goes on and on and on and on into detail. One story after another, he lends him money. It's a long, complicated story. If you want the details, read this month's issue of Culture Wars magazine, where I go into the details here. But what is the point? What is the point here? The guy loses his business. The Jew ends up in charge. Exactly. It's exactly the same thing that happened to Jack Nicklaus. Exactly the same thing. And this is the guy who's writing 80 years before the whole thing happened. So the culmination of one of these stories is that Mr. Linton had a farm. The money, he borrows money to do something on the farm, and gradually he falls in arrears on his payments and the Jews take over. But they don't want to keep him. They don't want to kick him out. That would be nasty. So he can get to live as a servant on his own farm, which is now owned by the Jews, because the Jews need service. They don't work, so they need someone to run the farm. That's how it ends. And it said, this is how Roth puts it. Someone had to be dispossessed so that his relations might have a home. Linton realized with a sinking heart that he really had no chance. His whole life had been lost the moment he crossed Levy's threshold. He had been dealing not with a man, but with a whole people. Do you realize how significant that is? Because what he's doing is substantiating the category, right? In other words, this is not just Mr. Milstein. It's not Mr. Shapiro. It's a culture of predatory contracts that they have mastered over centuries and can basically dispossess anybody who's stupid enough to sign up their contract. This is precisely what Crowder was involved in. You're not dealing with a man. You're dealing with the whole people, or what I would say, the category called the Jews. And if you don't understand that it's a category, and you don't understand, you better be wary, you'll end up like Jack Nicklaus, the ultimate dumb goy who doesn't even know his name anymore, own his name anymore, can't even talk to someone unless he has the permission of Mr. Milstein.
And still struggling to be polite.
Yeah.
Worrying about, you know, how it looks.
Yeah. So I think that's what's going on here. Now, people, it's been broken down. They're, you know, the back people siding with one side or the other. But I think that's the gist of what happened here.
Yeah, it is interesting you point out the difference between money and wealth, of course. Money, of course, is just a... Well, ideally, it's there to facilitate exchange, you know, way above and beyond barter.
Exchange, it's a store of value. And
store, yeah. Of course, money can be weaponized, especially if the currency is debauched. You know, it becomes a tool of wealth extraction as opposed to wealth preservation.
Right.
You know, so under the current system, that's what it is now, yeah.
Let's go back to the moment that Jack had been waiting for. He's there. He has the check for $150 million. He's 70 some years old. Jack, what are you going to do with this? What are you going to do now? What are you going to do?
Buy toys?
Well, that's what I was thinking. Go to Walmart. I'll take one of everything.
Yes.
Now, Adam Smith dealt with this in the Wealth of Nations. He talked about the Highland lairds who had men at their command but didn't have money. This is the landed aristocracy always had this problem. You have land, which is a source of wealth, but you need money. And so he said that he exchanged his men for a pair of silver buckles on his shoes, and they have diamonds on them too. That's what he said. So what's he saying? He's talking about luxury items. He wanted to buy luxury items. Maybe Jack wanted to buy luxury items. He said that he wanted to, you know, I don't know, help out his family or something like that. It was, anyway, the only sensible thing you can do with $150 million is invest it. And what do you mean by invest it? Well, labor is the source of all value. So you have to find a machine that will turn labor into money. Now, that's called a business. Well, he already had a business. He had a thriving business of building golf courses. Well, what's he going to do now? Find another business to invest in when he already has? This makes no sense. And in this discussion, you start to see the difference between money and wealth. Wealth is what you need. Labor is the source of all value. You need something that, as I said, that's going to turn labor into money. That's known as a business. So you have to find a business. You have to create a business. And then you generally have to use your own labor in one, some way or another to do this. You can buy stock in a company, something like that. There are all kinds of instruments you can use. But ultimately, it's all going to come down to something like buying labor, buying someone else's labor and getting a return on your investment. That's what it's going to have to be. So why did you do this? It's like, I really, you know, you cut down the apple tree because someone gave you a lot of apples. Well, what happens after you've eaten all the apples? Then what? Well, you got to buy some more. Whereas if you had the apple tree, you could have a constant supply of apples. Now, obviously, that requires work, doesn't it? Which, as I said, labor is the source of all value. So if you want something for nothing, well, then, you know, you're going to get into trouble because ultimately you're not going to get it. The only alternative, and this is the whole gist of my book, Barren Metal. The only alternative to the theory that labor is the source of all value is Shylockian economics of the sort practiced by Mr. Milstein and described by Mr. Roth, which is basically usury. And so Shylock says, you know, my ducats can copulate faster than Laban's ewes and rams. And I'd like to lend you some money. I want to be your friend. Again, you have the same pattern here. Now we're in literature 100 years ago. You can go back to Roth. Now we're in Shakespeare. It's the same thing. I want to be your friend. I want to lend you some money. I want to help you out. And Antonio is smart enough to say, if it's breed of barren metal, then keep it. Friends don't lend friends money. And that's that whole play revolves around that issue. This is obviously something that Jack Nicklaus didn't know. And Steven Crowder apparently didn't know it either. You're not just dealing with one man. You're dealing with a people. In other words, a group of people called the Jews, a category of this group of people that have been doing this for years, centuries. And Roth mentioned that when they get together, they talk about how, you know, how they pulled the wool over the dumb goy's eyes and stole his money. They don't even get satisfaction from making money without exploiting him. Now, this is, I know it sounds anti-Semitic, but tell that to Samuel Roth. He was a Jew who was cheated by other Jews. I'm just trying to link all these incidents into some type of coherent pattern so you can understand it.
Yeah, it is interesting that they dangle money out in front of Jack Nicklaus or Steven Crowder to get them to sign their life away in a way, their control over their product or their life or their identity. And it's the lure of money tricks people into agreeing to something like this. And here is sort of this inexorable force of usury in concentrating wealth enables this group to come in and take over first the finances and then society in general, because that wealth is, that they concentrate is then leveraged culturally and politically. Right. At that point, they can control the discourse. And
that's the whole point of the Daily Wire. Let's control the discourse, which means we, you know, it's like Ben Shapiro. Oh, he's invited to the Right to Life group. And the one thing he's not going to mention to the Right to Life group is that abortion is now a fundamental Jewish value. That's because he's a conservative. And if you're a conservative, you don't say things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole point of that. You know, but let's go back to the contract, Crowder's contract. Let's say, you just got banned, Steve. You just got deplatformed. Okay, Google, Twitter, whatever it is. So we're taking 50% of what we were planning to pay you. Oh, so now we're down to $25 million. And if you keep going along this way, we're going to keep taking more money. And I think that was pretty much the thing that shocked him when he read the contract. Well, does that mean that, let's say we're down to zero now. You've pissed off so many people. You got deplatformed. So you're down to zero now. But that doesn't mean you're free to leave. We own you now. We own your name. And so you're going to continue to do what we want you to do. And we're not going to pay you anything. I mean,
and another group that's part of this category, like the ADL, will determine what causes someone to be canceled or to be deplatformed. Yeah,
it's a rigged game here.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose we have the board meeting. Now, this is all hypothetical. Suppose we have the board meeting and Ben and whatever the guy's name is. You know, I've been listening to Crowder. He just doesn't have it anymore. Call up Jonathan Greenblatt and tell him to get him deplatformed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, is that impossible to think that something like that? I mean, that's an awful thing to say. I'm sure Ben Shapiro, if he's listening, is ready to denounce me as something or other. But it is within the realm of possibility. And you signed a contract where, just because we're not paying you doesn't mean you don't have to work for us, right? I mean, who knows the way this contract... Well, take it to a Manhattan judge, Stephen. That's what Jack Nicklaus did, and he sided with... Oh, I'm surprised. He sided with the Jew here. You know?
Well, we live in a society now where if you don't think that trans women are women, or that maybe you shouldn't take an experimental gene-modifying mRNA drug, that's enough to get you canceled, right? Yeah. Now, that's beyond the acceptable public discourse as determined by the ADL organization. Yeah.
Who knew before COVID that you didn't have the right to protest against vaccines? Who knew? Who knew that was a controversial topic?
COVID?
And then talk to somebody like Dr. Mercola. What happened to him?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the way they ganged up on him, the guys, what's the guy? He was trying to sell vitamin D. Is that controversial? He's trying to say, well, vitamin D probably provides you with more protection against COVID than the vaccine. Well, why can't he say that? Well, he can't, because the big pharma and big tech and this. I just read the thing today, and then there's a group called People United Against Hate. Well, wait a minute. Now, since when is vitamin D hate speech? I didn't look into it, but, you know, it sounds like a Jewish operation to me. Whenever I see the word hate, I think of hate speech, and that was created by the ADL to shut down any type of discourse that they don't like.
Well, that's the thing here. The issue is, one, as you pointed out, you spelled out, is the issue of the contract, the predatory or unconscionable contract, the exploitative nature of the business relationship that they're so well-trained in creating, or at least presenting to the hapless goy. But the other issue is how they use this contract to determine public discourse, to shape it, to take over, so they can control what's considered acceptable in these debates. So if, say, Steven Crowder were to comment on something, some egregious act by the part of Israel in Palestine or something, and he were to comment on it, then that would be considered, they wouldn't like that, and they could again call up the ADL to come up with some pretext to have them canceled. And again, YouTube is not obligated. YouTube, again, owned by Google, which is also a Jewish operation with ADL, linked, or, you know, the commas are there determining what's acceptable. We saw that, you know, the Twitter files exposes that.
Yeah, sure.
So yeah, they can basically, what there's that they dangle the money out by you, and then they can control your product, control public discourse, and that's, then they're off to the races. That's how we got the Jewish century.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's how they control the discourse.
You know, it is, and you talk about usury, and you talk about Jack Nicklaus and going and finding out he's in debt and wanting the money, and it is analogous to the experience of the British aristocracy in the 19th century.
Absolutely.
And how the British Empire was kind of folded into the Rothschild Empire through usury.
That's right. That's exactly right. And also, I keep coming back to the literary example is Faust.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think Faust is about usury, because I think it's like borrowing money, except that you're borrowing from the devil. And there was in the late Middle Ages in Germany, there were things like the devil and the Jew being conflated, because it's sort of in scripture, you know, when Jesus says your father is Satan,
mm-hmm.
that type of thing. So it's not too far-fetched to say that the Jew and the devil are aligned here in this thing. But you signed a contract. Now, at this point, and usury is illegal. And so if you sign a contract that is illegal, it's not binding. Well, that's not what happens when you sign it with the devil. And the whole point of the Middle Ages did not accept that traditional term, pacta sunt servanda, which comes from the Roman Empire, which is contracts are to be honored. Because if it's, and so the rising banking industry in places like Geneva felt that they could never trust Catholic princes, because the Catholic princes would always renege on their debts, because they shouldn't have made them in the first place. It's not a legitimate contract. And this led, I think this is the hidden grammar behind the Glorious Revolution. The British wanted a Protestant who would honor usurious contracts. And I think that's what they got with King Billy the Dutchman, who wanted to wage war in France. So what's the first thing they do, the Whig oligarchs who brought him over? They lend him money. And this is the whole purpose of the Bank of England, which they started at the same time.
That's right, to get right after Patterson sets up the Bank of England on the model of the Dutch Central Bank, yeah.
Yeah, so now King Billy can wage war, and now everybody's happy, and the Whigs, this is what Cobbett said, once they created the Bank of England, you divided England into two classes of people. Taxpayers, which is the majority, and then tax eaters, which are the Whig oligarchs who own the bank. It looks like some type of public enterprise, but no, it's privately owned, just like the Fed. Oh, mm-hmm. Wait a minute. There's a pattern emerging here, isn't it? Isn't there? If we can't make connections like this, we are always going to be the dumb goy who's going to sign his life away on a contract.
Roughly like every 75 years, the system collapses under its own weight, right?
Well, that's the term for a floating loan.
Yeah.
You can't have a floating loan. At that point, the exponential nature of the increase kicks in, and it skyrockets, and that's precisely what happened with the Bank of England. So we're talking about 1763. Oh, I know. So Lord Townsend, who's the Chancellor of the Exchequer, goes to Adam Smith and says, we can't pay off the interest anymore. And so Smith says, I know, we'll get the colonies to pay for it. We'll pass the Stamp Act. And the colonies didn't like that, and that led to the American Revolution, which is pretty much what you have to do when you're in a situation like this. We may be in a situation like this ourselves right now. I have this gloomy feeling about 2023 and what's going to happen this year. But this is, it's inevitable. It's inevitable because of the nature of compound interest and a floating loan. The best example I gave in Baron Metal was the Habsburgs. They borrowed from Catholic usurers, the Fugger family from Augsburg. First loan, I think it was in 1494. They came into the possession of every gold and silver mine in the New World, and they went bankrupt in 1555. Now, how can you go bankrupt when you own every single gold and silver mine? Because of the nature of compound interest on a floating loan after something like 70 years.
And I think roughly 70, 75 years after, of course, the Townshend Acts and the American Revolutionary War, you have the Irish potato famine, which was actually aggravated by usury because it was the indebted aristocracy that had to pay off the Jewish creditors, which forced them to forcibly export the food from Ireland to make good on their debt. And of course, the Irish suffered for that.
That's right. Palmerston, Lord Palmerston, classic example, had all these lands. He's an absentee lord in Ireland. And in order to pay the usurer, he has to grind the poor tenant farmers there. Until the point he realized, like, I can't afford them anymore. I know, I'll ship them off to America. And they were the Irish at this time, the time of the potato famine, arriving on Grand Isle, anyway, that island in the middle of the St. Lawrence River, where the ships landed, crawling naked into the snow of Canada. They didn't even have a clothing to wear when they were shipped off from Ireland to Canada. So it's kind of the unwritten history of what's been happening here for centuries, and it's still happening. And Crowder was only a recent example of the same type of thing.
It's funny how they take something like the contract or capitalism, which people associate with voluntary contracts and freedom, but hidden within that with usury is multiple levels of coercion, which foreclose people's opportunities and corner them. So they have to make bad choices, whether it's going into debt to maintain a standard of living or to keep a roof over your house, or to sell yourself into prostitution, like in Weimar Germany.
Yeah.
And the exploitation then is called free market, same way that Paul Singer talks about. It's the free market, right? It's at the market. As he uses the court system to extract the pound of flesh from Latin American countries.
Yeah, supposedly it was never a vulture capitalist, as Paul Singer. And by the way, it was one of those New York judges that made him his fortune with the bad debt with Argentina,
mm-hmm.
where the whole deal had been agreed upon. They were going to, everybody's to take a haircut. You're going to get 10 cents on the dollar. So he buys up distressed debt. And then he toes to the Manhattan judge and he says, he's got to be made paid in full face value. A completely crooked Jewish operation here that inflicted misery on the Argentinian economy. And then,
it's kind of a replay of that you write about in Baron Metal, the Don Passo affair. Is that where the Greek, he's a British, a Jew, I guess a Jew in Britain who resigned his citizenship, but he had a debt with one of the with Greece, and the British Navy collect for him, threatened to bombard. They didn't pay out or something.
British Navy.
Yeah.
So that's they he suddenly discovered he was English after all, and the British.
Yes.
This is why they had a navy. If you don't pay our debt, you don't pay off what you owe us, we'll send the ship in and we'll bombard your port or whatever. That's why they had it. The navy is Leviathan.
Mm-hmm.
Leviathan is a sea monster. The Japanese call him Godzilla.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, it's the monster that comes out of the sea. That's the British Navy. And it comes out. It will destroy you if you don't pay off your debts.
And now it's NATO.
NATO.
The American Anglo-American Zio Empire.
And do you know the one thing, the one nut that the British Navy could not crack? It was the Eurasian landmass.
Mm-hmm.
Too far inland, sorry, fellas. And this is precisely the Mackinder thesis. And now what you're seeing here is the end game of the Mackinder thesis. By the way, George Friedman just said exactly this. He used to be called Spengler. He's got his own kind of think tank where he talks about geopolitics. Anyway, he said, look, the whole Ukraine operation is really about the Mackinder thesis. And what you're really talking about is any time that Germany makes an alliance with Russia, we are going to invoke this. They did. And I think you can make a plausible case that the real goal of this war is to destroy Germany.
Which has always been the goal. This is the conflict between labor and user, isn't it? Because Germans were the ultimate laborers in producing wealth.
And they were able to... basically break out of this usurious thing in any number of different ways. And the man who really broke out of it was that guy we're not allowed to mention, Adolf Hitler.
Oh, by the way, today's the anniversary of his rise to power in Germany. Yeah, it was 90 years ago today. Yeah. We're recording on January 30th. Yeah.
Yes, I can hear the champagne corks pop ADL. to Adolf Hitler, without whom we would not be what we are today.
These things, it wasn't just that issue wasn't just the 12 years that Hitler reigned over Germany. It's the whole several actually centuries. But yeah, it was that Mackinder thesis. Germany became a problem after 1871 when they unified. Right. And you had the trade union there between Germany and this productivity, and it started to challenge British economic financial power, which is actually with Rothschild financial power, and so it had to be broken up. So you got the 30 Years' War in the 20th century, we call World War One and World War Two.
Right. You know. And Hitler, after he brought in shocked work during the Weimar Republic. He's the one who orchestrated the inflation as a way of paying off debt. And then Hitler brought him back. And then the second time around, Schacht restarted the German economy without one piece of gold. First time he tried to borrow some gold, the English Montague and Norman, the head of the Fed in America, went along with it. Second time they're not, no, we're not going to give you any money. And he jump-started the economy, got Germany out of the depression, purely with labor. That's all they had. And so it became, you suddenly understood the ultimate value of money, or what is money ultimately? It's credit based on the future labor of the nation guaranteed by the sovereign. That's what it did. And so Germany started pumping money into the economy to build the Autobahn, then to build armaments. And they dragged the whole German economy out of the recession, something that Roosevelt could not do. First of all, because he had an idiot, Morgenthau, who didn't know anything other than how to lick Franklin Roosevelt's boots. They were friends. They were neighbors in New York. Did nothing on the economy. He was a total, had the reputation of being a total idiot. No one would know the man's name if it weren't for the Morgenthau plan, which is the only thing he really came up with, which was how to starve Germany to death by deindustrializing.
Mm-hmm.
But the what came out during this period of time is that Hitler proved, I hope that someone listening here, they're gonna, he proved that labor is the source of all value, because he resurrected the economy on German labor alone. And German labor was very valuable
mm-hmm.
at this point. Probably the best labor in the world. I don't think that's an exaggeration.
It still is. That's why the country tried to destroy it.
That's why the United States...
Starve it.
This is so the hidden grammar, this is Eugippius said this, but basically other people are saying it in Germany. So the real point of pressuring Olaf Scholz to send tanks to the Ukraine is basically they're all going to get destroyed, and then you're going to have to buy tanks from us, and then you will destroy your own armaments industry. This is the whole point, and the Germans are going along with this. I can't believe what I'm seeing here.
Same thing with the liquefied natural gas, right, when they blew up the pipeline, which Victoria Nuland last week was gloating in front of the Senate about it.
Yeah, to Cruz. Cruz is on board with this too. This is an act of war against the German people, and the docile German people are going along with it. Unbelievable. It's unbelievable. It's
One thing, again, what this points out again is obviously we're talking about the sort of the force of usury and able to leverage to take over an economy and then leverage it culturally and politically. Is again, this what they do is they turn around and they regurgitate this ill-gotten gains to control public discourse institutions. There was a recent article I came across here. Let's see here. At Harvard's Kennedy School, Kenneth Roth, who ran Human Rights Watch, of course he's Jewish, was he ran it for nearly 30 years, and he be was offered a senior fellow position at Harvard's Kennedy School until the dean Douglas Elmendorf turned him down. And apparently, this was a result of pressure from various Jewish organizations because Human Rights Watch has been very critical of Israel and pointed out human rights abuses and war crimes. And so it was immediately withdrawn. Now the Kennedy School of Government is funded largely from Leslie Wexner. Know him from
Oh, where have
Jeffrey
we,
Epstein.
where have we been
Jeffrey
behind?
Epstein infamy.
Yes.
Another one, Robert Belfer. Again, these are people who have tied into the American Jewish Community, ADL. David Rubenstein, he's another Jewish billionaire who's he I think he's one that's like causing he gave money to like Monticello and other historical sites and turned it all woke and a lot of racial agitation with slavery.
He's the man behind the Carlyle Group.
Yeah, the Carlyle Group. And there's buildings named after I guess a shipping magnate, Israeli shipping magnate Ofer, David Rubenstein and Leslie Wexner. But it was funny because the with offer was withdrawn after pressure. Again, Kenneth Roth is Jewish, but he's a critic of Israel. And
This is good because it allows us to define our terms better. Okay.
yes.
Like Samuel Roth, he was a Jew too, right?
Yes.
Spill the beans. So what do we mean when we say the Jews? The Jews. Does that include every Jew?
Well,
No.
obviously not. No, yeah.
No, obviously not. It's a political entity, is a political mobilization of this group, which is basically run by big, influential, moneyed Jews who get to determine the political agenda of the Jews. Little Jews can often get the ground under the juggernaut if they don't go along. Roth. Now there's another Roth.
Or was the guy Mordecai Vanunu, right? Another one. Oh, well, there's an article written about this, I think, covering, I guess, pointing out the role of these Jewish benefactors or billionaires, philanthropists, if you will, in bringing pressure to bear on the Kennedy School government to withdraw the offer. Of course, Jonathan Greenblatt pops up, ADL's, and he wrote an article, of course, condemning the anti-Semitism. He says typical anti-Semitic tropes that infect journalism. I think Michael Massing was the journalist, but this is what David Jeffrey Jonathan Greenblatt wrote. He goes, the article further devolves into Jewish maker name dropping, Leslie Wexner, Jeffrey Epstein, Robert Belfort, David Rubenstein. And notes their supposed close ties to big Jewish organizations. It's a
What?
textbook case of classic anti-Semitism. It's not the leadership of the Kennedy School government that made the decision. Oh no, it's the powerful, moneyed Jewish elite that really influenced these things behind the scenes. In short, the article plays in the classic anti-Semitic trope of Jewish power and control without providing any evidence that any of these Jewish donors or groups played any role in influencing the decision to derail Ken Roth's fellowship. So there he is. Again, I guess Jonathan Greenblatt is so. I guess very sure of his own intelligence and his fellow tribes members' intelligence, and of course everyone else's stupidity in believing that tens of millions on $100 million in donations don't reflect the decisions taken by the Kennedy School of Government.
I did a interview with Iranian TV with a guy I'd met over there, and there's a series of people, and there's a report in I think it's Memory, the Jewish operation this, and it's going on, and then they get to Ron Unz, and they're going about how this guy's an anti-Semite because he, wait a minute, you forgot to mention he's a Jew. That doesn't count as anything anymore. They wouldn't even mention that he was a Jew.
Because, I guess Norman Finkelstein's an anti-Semite too, right?
Yeah, and yeah. So you have to keep this in mind. It's like the time of the Jews killed Christ. You know, that's a true statement. Does that mean every Jew in Jerusalem shouted "Crucify him"? Does that mean the Blessed Mother and the beloved disciple Saint John yelled "Crucify him"? No, of course not. When you're talking about the Jews, you're talking about major Jewish organizations. You're talking about the Sanhedrin, whatever it's called at this day, who control the political entity known as the Jews, mm-hmm. for their benefit.
Yeah. And it gets that category. And conservatism is there to so we make that categorical error, and we can't name the group, the people. You know, that Sam Roth was writing about, dealing with the people.
You're dealing with a people. That's exactly what we're talking about here. Yeah. A group that is mobilized politically with wealth and power, who set the agenda, no matter what the little Jew thinks about it.
And that wealth of power is accumulated and utilized for social, political causes like, gay marriage, abortion, promoting sodomy. You feel war, and nothing. We're flirting with nuclear war because of Jewish influence in the State Department and in our Treasury Department.
The Sanctions Office is a Jewish operation. Sanctions Office at the Treasury that is alienated. 40% of the world's population is now under sanctions thanks to the Jews in the Treasury Department.
And when the dollar collapses because of the petrodollar, all this pressure, we won't be able to blame them because that's, again, we're not allowed to make that categorical issue.
No, because you don't have the category. You're not allowed to use that category.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you say, like Jordan Peterson, that Jews are intelligent. Now, okay. Okay, then. We can use the category. You know what I mean? Or Jews are victims of the Holocaust. And at that point, make the check out to me. So that category becomes real because the German government has to sign it.
Who endorses that check?
Yeah.
Where does it go?
Yeah, where does it go? Well, it didn't go to Norman Finkelstein's parents. That's clear.
No. Now it is. Jordan Peterson is a great example. Someone who's been offered, I guess, some money, and now he can't talk. He actually said that on stage. I can't talk about it.
I can't do it. He said. And the question he got asked was, "Did you read Solzhenitsyn's book 200 Years Together?"
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with that? You're not allowed to read the book. You become unclean because you read the book. That shows you the fear that.
But he is talking about Logos, right?
Did you see my article?
Yes. He just. Yeah.
Good. Well, then you saw the inside conversation.
I read that, and it's interesting. There's a video of him talking with Ben Shapiro and what's the guy, Ruben, the homosexual?
Yeah.
I think they're talking about Logos. Like, what does a homosexual know about Logos? little confused.
I mean, I was giving Jordan Peterson the benefit of the doubt. You know, I mean, good. He's telling kids to clean up their room. Mm-hmm. But then he goes, not only is he going to give a speech on Logos, they fly an entire class of people to Ephesus.
Yeah.
And he puts them up in front of that building, and then he opens his mouth, and the first thing out of his mouth is a category mistake. And then it just goes from bad to worse. The more he talks, the worse it gets. You know, so when moments, one of the few moments where you can actually understand what he's saying, he goes from a category mistake then to from stupidity to blasphemy when he starts talking about God. And chaos.
In the beginning, there was chaos, right? Is that what the gospel is?
That's not St. John. Jordan, stop. looking at his cell phone. He was looking at his cell phone the whole time. Suddenly the light goes up. Jordan, shut up. Stop. This is Ben. Don't say that. But he did. Made a fool out of himself. Said in the beginning there was chaos, which is the exact opposite of what St. John said. He said in the beginning there was Logos.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was never chaos. Never chaos. And this is blasphemous to associate chaos with the mind of God.
Yes.
Which is what he did. Made a complete fool out of himself.
Well, yeah. Well, that's like there's never nothing because there's something, and something can't come from nothing. So
that's right. That's exactly right.
But then he starts talking about Carl Jung, and like, what are you talking about? You're losing me here.
I think that's the one thing that formed his mind, which was Carl Jung, who was an alchemist. He's part of that hermetic alchemy tradition and doesn't believe in the principle of non-contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets away with it with his mandalas and all this other type of stuff. But it's, you know, how is that going to form your mind? Well, Jordan Peterson is proof that his mind is not formed.
Well, the big issue here, at least from an American standpoint, speaking as an American, and our current political crisis, what's happening right now, and all the insanity, clown world nonsense that we're seeing, either to distract us or just drive us all insane, make us more confused, and is the our system of government, our constitution, one thing that made it functional was that America enjoyed sort of a pan-Christianity, which formed the public order, moral order. And it was, I think it was John Adams who said that our Constitution presumes the existence of a moral people, and no government can function without it. And the Jews, and we talk about the Jews as a group, is because their Jewish revolutionary spirit and the war on Logos is they're, as a group, they've made war on morality.
Absolutely.
And public order. And so when you're dealing with our political crisis, our financial crisis, everything stems from the moral crisis, which they, as a group, have been promoting for the better part of a century in the United States since the late 19th century when they came over from the parallel settlement. Is that a fair summarization of the problem?
Exactly right. And they lure you
summation rather.
They lure you into a trap with sexual liberation. You know, they give you a permission slip to act on your illicit sexual desires, and they call it freedom. And you think, this is great. This is great. I can do whatever I damn well please. Until you wake up and you're addicted to pornography. And then suddenly you realize, well, wait a minute, we still have rules. It's not the moral law. It's the rule of the powerful. Truth is the opinion of the powerful. So if you have money now, you make the rules. That's how they do it. And that's the problem. That's exactly the situation we are in right now. So it was sexual liberation that destroyed representative government. Because now we have government, $1, one vote. And they buy up Congress. IPAC buys up Congress. If you don't go along with them, they will buy up someone who will defeat you in the next race. That's how we were led into slavery.
Mm-hmm.
By repudiating the moral law. Because the only thing that the little guy has is the moral law. As the basis for the civil law, where you can stand up to the man who is rich and powerful and say, you can't do that. It's wrong. It's wrong. I don't care how much money you have. It's wrong to kill, to commit to the sin of abortion. It's wrong to do this. It's wrong to exploit people. That's the only moral force that we have. That's the only force we have, and it's a moral force. And if we give it up for the ability to screw whoever we want, we will be their slaves. That's exactly what happened. We don't have representative government anymore. We have rich rule by the rich and for the rich and of the rich. And that's it.
If this was something that America was always vulnerable to, because America has always been about pursuing, well, one thing is pursuing happiness, that is pursuing money. And those who control the money can use it as a lure and a trick. And that's kind of what we see in American history from the get-go. I mean, starting with Hamilton's, you know, bond fraud with the Whiskey Rebellion to the manipulations of the Bank of the U.S., First and Second Bank of the U.S., and culminating in the creation of the Federal Reserve System in 1913, which was the huge coup. And it's been one, I guess, that's where you have, you know, usury institutionalized. And it is with compound interest, it's an inexorable force seeing. Yeah.
So it becomes the hidden grammar of things like the separation of church and state, or the fact that we don't have an established church, or the fact that you want to weaken religion, because that is what puts moral force in action. You have to have the Catholic Church as the defender of the moral order. But if you put them all, proliferation of sex is good. Sex, S-E-C-T-S, is good for the oligarchs because it weakens the moral force of religion. And once you weaken that, the power of money becomes more and more important.
Mm-hmm.
which is the situation we're in.
Yeah. And again, we see that with people like Jack Nicklaus or perhaps Crowder, who are being tricked by money. Crowder didn't sign, I don't think he signed the contract yet, but then money people are interpreting that as, look, he's being offered all this money, which somehow outfits like the Daily Wire apparently have a limitless source of. I wonder how that works. They're not just selling mugs, are they? T-shirts.
Where did Howard Milstein get $150 million to hand out? And that, of course, he took it all back. Where did the Daily Wire get $50 million? And that's probably small compared to what they gave to Jordan Peterson. Where is all this money coming from?
Mm-hmm.
Ad revenue on the Daily Wire? I don't think so. I don't think so. They have access to this money. They use it. They lure people into a trap. Then they take it back slowly. Oh, you got deplatformed. Sorry, we're not paying you anymore. But you still have to put out your videos. Or what happened to Jack Nicklaus, and so on and so forth.
That's, well, vulture capitalists like Paul Singer and Leslie Wexner will give, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions, away to get leverage or control of the culture. And this is where, whether it's Monticello or Daily Wire, you know, or any other media outlets, you know, or CBS News or Hollywood, you know, and so they're very good in spending their money in ways that serve, you know, their perceived interests, you know.
Yeah. Good at getting it, throwing it out there, and then getting it right back again.
Yeah. So, well, I think we covered. Do you think so? I think I said I had it for an hour, so.
Yeah. Yeah, that was good. That was good. We got a lot of cards on the table here. I hope people are listening and hope pay attention. This is a warning signal, and Crowder was the guy who started this whole conversation.
Yeah, $50 million seems like a lot of money, but if you break it down, it isn't, because he has like 25 employees. But also, it's not a lot if you in essence sell your soul to get it, lose your independence, and
Christian back, yeah. Because you got deplatformed or because you got a strike against you on Twitter. They're easy enough to orchestrate. That the double standard on Twitter is the guy who objects to you is always right. The guy who issues a complaint, he's always right.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have any way of replying to these people. Now, I think that Musk has reformed this, Tomo, but that is the rule on the internet.
Yeah, but big techs are full of Yul Roths. You know, these commerzars, these degenerate commerzars.
That's right.
And they always end up being Jewish for some reason. So, again, that category, that group. Well, Dr. Jones, I want to thank you for coming back on the show.
Thank you, Tim. It's always a pleasure.
Of course, culturewars.com. Subscribe to the magazine. You can get it either in Deadword version or PDF emailed to you at the beginning of the month. Of course, your latest book.
Right. And also, a lot of what we talked about tonight is in Barron Metal, History of Capitalism, yes. As the conflict between labor and usury. The whole idea of those two alternatives go back and forth is the history of how they interact with each other.
And again, yeah, the idea, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Culturewars.com or fidelitypress.org. Book is available there.
Great, excellent. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
Let's go. You have a nice evening then. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.